This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Walter Kern, has created a new religion for his new novel, Mission to America. The novel takes a satirical look at religious and secular contemporary life and the often uneasy relationship between them. Kern's 1999 novel, Thumbsucker, has been adapted into a film that's currently in theaters. Kern is also an essayist for Time magazine and a book critic. As we'll hear in a moment, Kern's family was converted to the Mormon faith when he was young, and he stuck with it for several years before becoming skeptical of religion. The religion he's created in his novel, the Church of the Aboriginal Fulfilled Apostles, approves of Christ as well as a host of other divinities. The two main characters are apostles who are sent out to recruit new members. As Kern says, this is a book about two pagans trying to convert Christians. In one scene, the main character, one of the apostles, listens to a man explain his Christian faith, and the main character thinks this man's Christian faith makes little sense. He believed in the Bible, but only in the one Bible, as though God had retired a couple of thousand years ago, having said everything he wished to say. He believed that the murder of Christ won the world forgiveness, but that people still had to ask for it as well. He believed that our physical bodies were glorious, but also needed to be overcome. I asked Walter Kern if this describes aspects of Christianity that baffle him.
I remember growing up always being confused by the fact that we'd been forgiven, this great sacrifice had happened, but we still had to get down on our knees and sort of ask for its benefits. I thought, well, that's a little redundant and trivial, isn't it? I also have always felt, you know, I grew up a Mormon, that this teaching about the body being both this, you know, wonderful gift from God and this horrible agent of temptation was just too paradoxical to comprehend. And I think that Mason, the narrator in my book, talks plainly and asks straight a lot of the questions that I think every child has about especially Christian religion, the Christian religion.
Now, you were brought up as a Mormon. Were your parents born into the Mormon faith, or did they convert to Mormonism?
No, and we were converted by missionaries who came knocking on the door one day when I was 12 and asked to be let in to show us a movie. One of the reasons that I think I wrote a novel about two missionaries sort of cruising for converts is that, you know, two such people changed my whole life when I was a teenager.
There's a scene just like this, or just like what you're describing in your novel Thumbsucker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tend to go around in circles in my writing. It's like a person who keeps trying to solve the same problem in the middle of the night and coming up with different answers. That's what my books are like, I think. But yeah, there is a scene like that. And this book actually began as a book about Mormon missionaries. And then I sat back and thought, you know, there's so much baggage that comes with Mormonism. And you have to be true to the theology. And first of all, I hate research.
But you did a lot of it. Come on.
Well, no, you know, I did a lot of it, but it was the kind I didn't know I was doing. I was able to take things that I'd read anyway and thoughts I'd been having anyway and somehow make them coalesce. But, you know, as I found myself writing the novel, I thought, not only do I want to create a new religion, I want to create one that I can respect personally. I don't want to send two people out on a quest to spread a message that I'm snickering at. I want to, you know, within the boundaries of these people's supposed time and place, create a belief system that I could subscribe to and a message that I would want to bring to the country that we find ourselves living in.
Yeah, well, so what is that message that you wish you could bring?
More than anything, I think the important difference between Mason and his partner and the rest of the world is that they're accepting, serene, and rather fatalistic. They abjure comparison above all. You know, they go on in the book about the fact that people would be happy if they learned simply not to compare what they have with what others have or what they might get or what they used to have. And more than anything, these are people who take things as they come and find the miraculous in the moment. And those are the exact qualities that are lacking in the people they minister to.
Now, as you mentioned, your parents were converted to the Mormon faith by a couple of missionaries who came to the door when you were living where?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay. Now, one of the things I find interesting about that is I think just about everybody, at least everybody I know, has had Mormons knock on the door and mm-hmm. Seventh-day Adventists, you know, who have tried to talk with them and, you know, possibly convert them. And yet, outside of you, I don't know of anybody who's ever been converted by a door-to-door encounter like that. What right. was it about this door-to-door encounter that made your parents think, yeah, this is it. This is the truth I want to live by.
It's a question of statistics, Terry. I mean, you probably don't know anybody else who's opened a penis enlargement email on their AOL account, and yet they're still coming. And that's because one out of every 1,000 people open them, you know, or direct mail. You know, who opens this stuff? You think, well, somebody does because there's a whole industry built around it. And somebody opens the door to these people, which is why they keep coming. Our family happened to be the ones that did that day because of internal problems in the family. My dad was having a nervous breakdown. We were living in a strange city where we knew no one. Here come two friendly guys who don't look like they're going to rob us, and they want to talk to us. I think they said about what would happen to our family after it died, you know, which none of us had thought about before, and for some reason felt in the mood to discuss. And, you know, once the social encounter begins in earnest, it's hard to back out of, is all I can say. You know, these two friendly guys who we wanted to like us were very persistent, and before we knew it, we were baptized.
So you were there at this first meeting?
Yeah, I was. It was a time of great turmoil in our house. We weren't even supposed to let the postman in because the house was dirty and everything. And I think the missionaries looked over my shoulder and probably from their training could tell immediately that something bad was happening there. And that made them zoom in.
What was the bad thing that was happening?
Oh, everybody was unhappy and there was a lot of financial stress. And my father's father had just died and he was deep in grief over that. And you know, missionaries, I don't know, psychiatrists or something, have a very probing eye, and they can tell when their services might be needed. And maybe there was something in our yard, hadn't been watered for a long time or something.
Now, your parents were adults, and, you know, they could make up their minds if they wanted to change their life and change their religion. You were 12, and I think when you're 12, you basically follow the faith of your parents or choose not to. But were you as convinced as your parents of wanting to convert to the Mormon faith?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, one I explore in the book. It's possible to be in a religion and to carry out its rituals and so on without deeply confronting the truth of the thing or the question of whether one really believes it. And so, you know, at first I went through the motions of Mormonism, and they were baffling motions, let me tell you. I mean, you know, we went on a bus trip to the Garden of Eden, which I found out was located in Missouri, according to the Mormons. You know, that was a lot of information to take in. But you're surrounded by people who seem to believe. You're surrounded by people who even seem to be inspired. You learn by doing, so to speak. You act as if, as the psychiatrists say, and pretty soon you're a little happier too. And you're smiling like the rest of them. And then pretty soon a newcomer comes who was as baffled as you were originally, and you're able to reassure them. And that gives you a sense of power. And the end result is you didn't know it, but now you're a Mormon.
What were some of the things that made the most sense or seemed most beautiful to you about the faith when you started practicing it?
That church? I can tell you easily, the things that seemed most beautiful were the women.
How do you mean that?
The young women. For there was, I don't want to go into it. It sounds like some kind of profiling, but young Mormon women were precociously well put together, seductive, clear-skinned, clear-eyed in a way that I found magnetic. You know, I was 12, so I probably would have found the young women of any religion magnetic. It just happened to be that one. And so in a strange way, it was sex that kept me in the Mormon church. You know, in the religion I created in Mission to America, they sort of frankly let sex be a part of their religion. And I think it's a part of most of them. You know, most faiths prosper and continue by getting their members to marry each other. And in order to do that, they have to make them attractive to each other. And the Mormon church does a wonderful job of that.
Had your parents been a part of any religion before becoming part of the Mormon church?
Just the sort of, well, I guess we were Presbyterian, you know, which doesn't demand much. You just call yourself Presbyterian, and at some point you dig up a baptismal record from, you know, 1½, an age you don't remember. No, not much. We were just sort of suburban middle-class Americans who didn't think about these things.
So how did the rules of the game in your life change after the conversion? And, you know, you're about to go through puberty, this is the age where you start making your own choices in music and movies and books. And it's...
There was none of that. There wasn't any of that own choices business, let me tell you. Yeah, you're supposed to. And then I got to college and met all these people who had... and tried to play catch up. No, I mean, it was completely disorienting. Pretty much all I had, like I say, was the pretty girls and the dances they held once a month. It wasn't that this church frowned on, you know, pop culture. It's just that they kept you so damn busy with other things that you didn't have any time for it. As far as sexuality went, I had to channel all that, you know, new erotic energy into staring at the girl in a very long dress across the aisle from me at the Sunday service. You know, I got better at undressing women with my eyes than I can imagine almost anyone in history. I had to take off more layers than but you know, after a while you know, a 12-year-old can eroticize any environment, and I managed to do that with the, you know, with my Mormon ward. I didn't get to delve into music and pop culture in the way that other kids did, I didn't miss it much.
When you were 12 and your parents converted and you did too, you describe a certain type of new religion as part of an eccentric quest for meaning. Did you feel the need to search for meaning at the age of 12? Did you feel that there was a void in your life that required some larger, you know, spiritual or philosophical framework?
That's the sad thing about being a child. You're dragged around by your parents while they make their quest for meaning, you know, and you just have to dress according with whatever answer they find. I mean, they could have taken me to India, you know, and taken me to an ashram. They could have become Wiccans or, you know, sun worshippers, and I would have had to do whatever they said. No, I wasn't looking for meaning at 12 years old. I was looking, you know, to kiss a pretty girl. I was looking to maybe meet Farrah Fawcett someday. And I just had to participate in their hegira. That was the word back then.
My guest is Walter Kern. His new novel is called Mission to America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Your station is fundraising today. Here on Fresh Air, we often talk about religion, like we're doing today. We talk with people of every faith, as well as with people who have dropped out of their religions or never had one. We talk with believers and skeptics and seekers. We hope you appreciate the different points of view and that you'll support these conversations with a pledge. Thank you. Thank you. My guest is Walter Kern. His new novel, Mission to America, is about the apostles of a new faith. When we left off, Kern was describing how his family converted to the Mormon faith when he was 12. Are you looking for meaning now, and is any form of religion a part of your quest for that?
I feel a little like one of the missionaries in the book. He believes before he comes out into the wider world that, you know, everyone is parched for meaning and hungry for the spirit. And what he finds is that the country is glutted on spirit. I mean, they're arguing about religion. Their TV shows are about it. They got bumper stickers on their cars and billboards next to the highway preaching this, preaching that. And, I mean, he's overwhelmed. It's like he expected to come to a starving desert country and instead walked into a, you know, hotel banquet. And I feel that a little bit about America. Sure, you know, I'm 43 years old. Everybody wants meaning, in some respect at that age. But that flood of answers and pseudo answers that come at me, I just find amusing and disorienting.
So do you practice any faith now?
Yeah, but it's probably so interior and idiosyncratic that I couldn't name it or describe it to you. Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. It's 2005. We've supposedly settled the question of where people came from, how they evolved, how our universe originated. We have computers that can, you know, do infinite numbers of calculations in half a second. And yet people are still wondering if UFOs exist and, you know, where we go after we die. Nothing that has happened in the last 2,000 years of scientific progress has made the slightest difference in comforting people when their relatives die. And so we're going to continue to be obsessed with these things long after we've answered almost everything else. And, you know, I'm a part of that, too.
Are your parents still Mormons?
No. My parents were Mormons for about 6 months, I think, after the conversion. It sort of gave them immediate relief from some problems. I stuck with it. It was horrible. I mean, I was constantly trying to get my parents to go to church because after I'd been inculcated, I did start to believe pretty fervently. You know, I was like one of those boy evangelist types. And I saw my parents as falling away. And, you know, I didn't want them to go to hell. Mormons don't really believe in hell. They believe that families go to heaven together. And I was afraid I was going to be in heaven all by myself and have to be looking at my family down on this lower plane, you know, trapped under glass, clawing to get out. So I was scared by the fact that they sort of just drifted away almost immediately.
So back when you stayed in the Mormon faith, even after your parents left it, mm-hmm. was it also a way to find some kind of stability? Because it sounds like your family at that time was in a pretty unhappy, troubled spot.
Absolutely. And it was for me a way to find family outside of my family, to find stability, to find a predictable social life. You know, I knew on what day next week the softball game would be held and the dance would be held and the service would be held. In my own family, I didn't know what time dinner was going to be served. But I think that's something that is misunderstood about what's this current sort of religious revival going on in the country. You know, people excoriate the religious right as bigots and so on, and a lot of the teachings seem to me to be pretty bigoted. But what people are really looking for out there is are nodes of community within seas of anonymous suburban sprawl. These mega churches go up and they give you a place for daycare, to meet your friends, to, if you're single, to meet other eligible single people, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that they're answering a real need, which is a need for community and pretty much of any kind, as long as it, you know, is there next week the same way it is this. And so I think politicians who are into either celebrating or excoriating the fundamentalist Christian movement without asking what need is it serving are way off base.
So since leaving the Mormon Church, have you ever had Mormons come to your door, not knowing who you were, seeking to give you the news about their faith?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I just say, I already am one. And then they say, well, we haven't seen you in church. And I said, and you're not going to. But I am one, and I haven't been excommunicated. I'm in some, I don't know theologically what my status is as far as church headquarters goes. I'm on their rolls, and they still know my phone number. Every time I change it, they know it. But I don't actively participate. And but it's a great answer to Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm a Mormon, you know. They that's like the Crips and the Bloods. They go to the next house.
Walter Kern, his new novel is called Mission to America. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist, essayist, and book critic Walter Kern. His new novel, Mission to America, is a satire about religious and secular contemporary life. His 1999 novel, Thumbsucker, has been adapted into a new film of the same name. This semi-autobiographical novel is about a teenaged boy who still sucks his thumb and tries to break the habit. Let's hear a scene from the film. The teenager, Justin, played by Lou Pucci, is in his orthodontist's office. The orthodontist, played by Keanu Reeves, realizes that Justin's thumb sucking is beginning to damage his teeth.
It's time we were honest with each other.
Yeah?
I don't want to fix your teeth all over again. It's time to confront the underlying issue.
What do you mean?
I know what your problem is. It's an understandable habit. In fact, what's strange is that people ever quit. It's nature's substitute for your mother's breast. How were you fed as a baby? From a bottle?
I can't remember.
Tension at home, anxiety, any bad memories?
No conscious ones.
We never remember the big things anyway. Some dumb babysitter holds her mouth shut so she can watch her soap operas in peace. At 40, you wonder why you can't stay married. There's only so much I can do with traditional orthodontics. Justin. Are you ready to let go of your thumb?
Now, your novel Thumbsucker has been adapted into a movie, and that movie is now playing in theaters around the country. This is a semi-autobiographical novel about your teenage years when you still sucked your thumb and tried to break the habit. How old were you when you actually broke it?
I like to say 18, and sometimes I say 23, sometimes I say 30, but I don't know that it's a habit you ever completely break. It's just something that you isn't in your repertoire anymore. I mean, I would say I stopped doing it sometime in my 20s, you know, but depression and heartbreak can pop it right in even now.
Was it embarrassing to you, and did the adults in your life insist that you find a way to stop, which is what happens in the movie?
Oh, it was beyond embarrassing. I mean, I was a Mormon thumb sucker. Everything about myself embarrassed me. I couldn't wait to get away and be the new person that I was designing in, you know, my journals. It embarrassed me totally. And the worst thing about sucking your thumb is you don't know you're doing it. It becomes an unconscious behavior after a while. And so you literally stand guard over your unconscious, you know, when you're, you know, in a classroom or riding a bus with your friends or at a dance. It's like please God, let me not suck my thumb at the prom. Then all of a sudden you look down and there it is, and you look around and there are your friends and there are the expressions on their faces, and you have to go be in the bathroom by yourself for a very long time. You know, that was my teenage years.
Did you end up taking Ritalin as a way to stop, as the character in your book does?
No, I did not take Ritalin at the time. I was prescribed it as an adult and took it for years as an adult, and then projected backwards in writing the book. And gave the main character a Ritalin prescription.
So what did you do to break the habit?
Got married. Probably let people into my life at such an intimate level that I literally couldn't afford to do it anymore, I think. I mean, there was no hypnosis. There was no conscious program of habit breaking.
You write in your novel, when people try to quit things, other things take their places. A woman stops smoking and starts inhaling pizza. Are there things that took a place, the place of your thumb as you tried to give up sucking it?
Oh, definitely. Well, I smoke.
Would you have been better off sucking your thumb than smoking?
Oh, that the whole premise of the book was about how much better I would have been if I just sucked my thumb and accepted it. Oh my gosh, I tumbled into everything. It was as though, you know, you stop a dog from, you know, wetting inside the house and it starts devouring mailmen. you know, I drank to excess, learned to play blackjack, you know, and found myself doing it for 36 hours at a stretch. In my 20s, I was just an obsessive decathlete. I mean, I had every obsession in the world and took them to the end of the world. And I thought, maybe if I had just kept sucking my thumb, I wouldn't be here in Las Vegas at 4 a.m. drunk, having lost $3,000, sitting next to a woman I'm in love with, but I just met tonight. That's why I wrote the book.
So do you think you're basically obsessive compulsive and the thumb sucking and all the things that took its place are a symptom of the same thing?
Well, you know, I've written about psychiatric disorders as a journalist, or let's not call them disorders, challenges, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, attention deficit disorder, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I've never taken one of those checklist tests that I haven't passed with flying colors. I've got all of them. And depending on which ones are covered by insurance, I'll confess to all of them. but I've got to say that the reason I write novels like Mission to America is that I think that there are larger forces at play in the human personality and in the cosmos generally, and that this attempt to medicalize and isolate all of our problems, behaviors, and longings just isn't working somehow. You know, until they should just invent a pill the size of the house, drop it on my head, and put me out of my misery, I think, sometimes. But, you know, it's made having had those problems and having had them sort of diagnosed has made me pretty suspicious of the industry which attempts to solve things for us.
What's made you suspicious of it?
Well, that everything they come up with basically works and doesn't work. What I love is how they'll invent an antidepressant, and then as the patent ages, they'll also reveal that it can cure social anxiety disorder, help with premenstrual syndrome, et cetera, because, I mean, these things really are just sort of feel-good pills that let loose streams of, you know, happy chemicals in the brain, and they're designated as treatments for everything. Well, ultimately, you realize what we're being treated for is living, you know, and living is the diagnosis, and being a human being is the problem, so to speak. And you've been through enough of these rounds with doctors or whatever, self-help books, and you realize maybe I ought to step back and not see myself as such a peculiar case and think about our condition generally.
So your new novel, Mission to America, is about religion, specifically a new religion. And Thumbsucker is, in a way, about therapy and diagnosis of, you know, psychological disorders. Do you see them as kind of flip sides of the same coin, which is meaning in the human condition?
Well, I mean, I think we live in a society that has a surplus. You know, we're not like the antelope on my ranch in Montana who basically spend every waking hour looking for a green blade of grass to eat and then looking for a place to lay down. We've got time on our hands. And, you know, idle hands are actually not the devil's plaything. They're God's plaything. When your hands aren't idle, you don't have time to think about these things. But we've got endless time to think, endless time to wonder, endless time to look up and ask questions of the stars, so to speak. And we've come to no definitive answers, and yet we've failed to rid ourselves of the appetite for seeking them. And so I just expect that this is sort of going to be the condition of our lives on this earth, you know, until the time comes when survival is at stake again.
My guest is writer Walter Kern. His novel Thumbsucker has been adapted into a new film of the same name. His new novel is called Mission to America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Walter Kern. His new novel, Mission to America, is a satire about contemporary religious and secular life and the often uneasy relationship between them. You're a father. How many children do you have?
Two.
Can I ask how old they are?
Yeah, five and or four and six.
Okay, so
I have a six-year-old girl and a four-year-old boy.
They're probably a little young for the territory of either therapy or questions about faith, but do you feel like you're prepared for that?
Well, they're actually not too young for questions of faith. A kid starts asking questions about where he came from, what happens after the dog dies, when they're able to speak. I mean, these are original, fundamental anxieties and questions in people, and you see that with little kids. And the answers you have to give them, you know, make you embarrassed to be an adult. You know, heaven, somewhere above the clouds, if you even say that it exists. If you don't say that it exists and that the dog just rots in the ground, the kid looks at you and doesn't believe that either, or else they go crying. So having to answer, one of the reasons I wrote this book really was that having to answer these innocent, naive questions from my children about religion and the universe and so on caused me to think about it a lot because I had such stupid answers for them.
So what answers have you been giving about what happens to my dog after he dies?
Well, you know, an Episcopal, after my daughter's dog died, an Episcopal priest gave me some book about dog heaven where dogs run forever in green pastures chasing ducks, and there's an old man with a white beard who sort of looks after them from afar. And, you know, it made her feel better, and I thought, okay, it works pragmatically, but it's the biggest bunch of baloney I've ever seen. So I tried to split the difference and say that what happens after you die is that you sort of go on as a feeling. And then I said, how do I know that? I don't. And I just tell her, nobody knows. You know, nobody knows where your dog went, but I'm sure it's not hurting. I can tell you that.
And does your daughter seem satisfied with that?
No. She wants, you know, the funny thing is she'd probably drag me to church at this point because, you know, here's dad with all these sort of heady, ambivalent, you know, ultimately dissatisfying answers And she just wants to go to a place where you find out that, you know, heaven is above the clouds, God has a beard, there are things you should do because you should and that you shouldn't do because you shouldn't. You know, she's searching for clarity, and what am I offering her? You know, some gray mist of, you know, spiritual nobility.
My guest is Walter Kern. His new novel, Mission to America, is about a religion, a new religion that he's created for the novel. His novel, Thumbsucker, was adapted into a movie that's currently playing in theaters. Let me ask you about a paradox in your life as a writer that I think is representative of a paradox in a lot of writers' lives. Your novel, Thumbsucker, is loosely based on one of the most embarrassing parts of your teenage and childhood years, which is that you sucked your thumb into your teenage years. This is something you would not have wanted to have admitted to other people who didn't already know it. But now, as an adult writer, it's, you know, it's an area that you, through fiction, went very deeply into. So can you talk about that desire as a writer to investigate the territory that earlier in your life you wouldn't have wanted anyone to know about?
Well, I don't know that it works as therapy to investigate your painful past as a writer. It's been said that it's good therapy. I don't think it is. Writers wouldn't be such screw-ups and, you know, famous alcoholics if it were. They'd be, you know, the healthiest people on the planet. You go back to it once you're at a safe distance. And you know, writers are interesting. They're performers in a sense, but they're hidden performers. They don't want to actually be on stage when the audience is physically present. They want to create this third object, the book, which they can present to the audience while they go and hide. And so writing about thumbsucking, say, was an interesting way for me to confront something that had actually happened, confess to feelings that I wasn't able to confess to, and not be there when people reacted to the story. You know, somewhere out there people were reading it, but I didn't know them, they didn't know me, and I'd made myself pretty unreachable by living in Montana. Then Hollywood goes and makes a darn movie about it. Now that threw me for a loop. The last thing I ever thought in my writing that would be turned into a movie was the story of me sucking my thumb. And to have to sit in movie theaters while an actor who pretty much resembled me sat up there with his thumb in his mouth and sit there next to my girlfriend, that was uncomfortable. I might have thought that I'd sort of overcome the whole thing, you know, distanced it, processed it, done all the things that therapists tell you you're supposed to do. No, like I would leave the theater with my girlfriend and feel like she's never going to want to touch me again. You know, I'm 2 feet tall. I felt horrible. I felt like I created a horrible trap for myself, in fact. I thought I was overcoming this problem by writing about it, and then it came back, you know, 20 times stronger on the big screen and brought back all the same feelings, which apparently hadn't gone anywhere.
Do you find those secrets, those really embarrassing things, are actually really interesting to think about as a writer?
Well, they're what link us. I mean, I had an editor once, my first editor, when I was writing short stories, first haltingly writing short stories, who said, you know, Kern, nobody wants to read about how handsome you are, how successful you are, how much money you make. They want to hear about your screw-ups, your most embarrassing habits. Those are the things we all have in common. Writers are trying to build bridges between the parts of people's selves that are hidden in social life. And I think he was right about that. So I don't think, you know, and the whole Oprah kingdom is built on this premise. You know, there's no problem so horrible that you can't confess to it in front of a live audience and get applause and a million emails. So in fact, I'm looking for new maladies that I might discover or diagnose in myself, you know, as a way to connect with that audience out there. I mean, I think of America as like millions of people living in their basements on and, you know, logging on to the internet trying to find people who have the same problems they do.
You know, sometimes I think the world divides into two parts. The people who know that we all have these, like, secret embarrassing problems and think that there's a solution to all of them, and that's, like, the self-help industry, or at least who want to market a solution. And then the people who have all these, like, embarrassing things that they think link us and think, but there's no hope.
you muddle through,
you do your best.
Well, you know, if the 20th century has been about anything in terms of therapy, it's been about forming small groups of people who share the same challenges. And now with the internet, I think, you know, if you have a problem, you know, let's say you, I don't know, paint portraits on your fingernails and feel naked without fully, you know, painted fingernails, you're going to find three people who have it too. And you can form a club and have a newsletter. And I think that's the great promise of human development right now, that, you know, there's a saying in high school that, you know, every rear end has a seat. and I think all the rear ends are finding their seats now over the internet. I really believe there's promise in that development.
Well, Walter Kern, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Walter Kern's new novel is called Mission to America. You can read an excerpt on our website at freshair.npr.org. His earlier novel, Thumbsucker, has been adapted into a new film of the same name. This is Fresh Air.